And I'm here today with an interview with Jeff Bass. He is a retired gardener and really has some innovative work that he's done in terms of regenerative agriculture. He was referred to me by Jamie Throgmorton, who I appreciate her connecting us. And, you know, we chatted for a bit and it just seemed like information that I think everybody would get some use out of. So, Jeff, thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Glad to do it, Jim.
Awesome.
Let me give a bit of background about myself. Yep. I'm a scientist, and I went to grad school in computer science, various forms of biology and statistics. And then I spent 20 years doing stats and data science at big biotech. I retired about 5 years ago and got involved with something called permaculture. And permaculture is just, I'd like to think of it as a revolution disguised as organic gardening. Mm. It's designing regenerative agriculture for long-term sustainability by creating deep living soil with diverse microbiology.
So what, what led you to that path? Like, have you always gardened? Is it something that you always had an interest in and, like, now had the time to kind of putz around doing, or?
There were a lot of things. I think, like probably a lot of your listeners, I was very concerned with the way things are going with atmospheric carbon and the old growth forest being cut down. So all throughout my career, I was also interested in these things. For instance, about 10 years ago, I put on a really large solar panel array because I wanted to, you know, get off the grid as much as possible. And my array is large enough that I produce seven times as much electricity as I use. So I'm a net producer.
Wow.
Nice. I also got involved with some permaculture folks. These are folks who are trying to take suburban lawns and convert them into food for us. And I have some neighbors doing that. I even have a neighbor who took a swimming pool and made it into a very diverse wildlife pond.
Really?
So these people influenced me to start permaculture. And permaculture, I mean, it's all about trying to get things as much as we can back to the way old forests were. Mm. That is, lots of diverse species, plant and animal, on every plot of land we can. And we want that deep living soil to be created. We can, you know, kickstart it with compost, but we want it to look like old growth forests did 20,000 years ago. Because what they do is they capture carbon better than anything else, probably.
So when we talked earlier, you had mentioned this idea that, you know, most of the soil that people have in their yards is dead. What do you mean by dead soil?
Well, when we think about the Europeans and their first introduction to North America, they brought with them their farming model. And that farming model is you plow up the soil, you cut down the trees, and you plant rows of monocrop. In a lot of Europe and Middle East, it was wheat. That was very different than what the native populations were doing here before the Europeans. They left the old growth forest in place. Very rarely did they cut down any trees. And they might cut down a few, build a clearing, and in that clearing plant a very diverse group of plants, corn, beans, squash, all planted together, and letting some of the native plants stay. So the agricultural model where you cut down all the trees, the first thing that happens is all that deep living topsoil, which initially was 50 to 60 feet deep, all of that over the first few years washes to the sea. So you're left with topsoil that has very little biology in it. And by biology, I mean microbiology, bacteria, fungi, planaria, all these things that grow in soil that help plants and trees grow. Trees actually produce most of the oxygen in our atmosphere. Our atmosphere way back when was basically methane and carbon dioxide, and some bacteria starting photosynthesis got the oxygen thing going. People can read about the great oxygenation event on Wikipedia or wherever. But the oxygen didn't really kick off until we had trees, because trees are a photosynthesis stack that's 50, 60, 200 feet high, and that's much more efficient than a, you know, 1 foot thick layer of algae in the ocean. Mm. 60 feet of photosynthesis is just way more efficient. So gradually, forests and trees made oxygen arrive at its current level of about 20% oxygen. The rest of the atmosphere is nitrogen, of course, and then there's carbon dioxide. But it is trees and forests that have the primary influence on maintaining that mix of a healthy atmosphere. Oxygen, nitrogen, carbon dioxide, other gases. When we cut down the trees, the soil washes away. If there isn't deep living soil, trees can't do their job of making oxygen very well. So dead soil is really dead. If you go look at a farm field in modern traditional agriculture, the agriculture we have, I call big ag, if you look at those fields, the soil is dead. I mean, it's uniform in color, but it doesn't have lots of stuff growing in it. There's no diversity of biology. They use chemicals to kill all of the life but the thing they're trying to go, such as corn or soybeans. Then they use pesticides to kill all the bugs that might eat those things. And the result is the soil is dead. There's no living bacteria in it. There's very little in the way of worms and other biology. And the plants that grow are just the ones they want to grow in rows. Mm. And they plow up every year to plant more rows. In a native old-growth forest, it's very different. The soil is an accumulation of fallen living matter that decays slowly, and that slow decay provides an environment for tree roots to take carbon down deep into the soil. Tree roots are in a partnership with soil microbiology. They use photosynthesis to make very simple carbon-based sugars that they push out through the roots to feed the bacteria and fungi that then break down minerals the tree can have. So it's a trade going on, a symbiosis. When we cut the trees down, the soil washes away and you can't get that deep soil back. What permaculture is trying to do is get people composting, mixing up the compost with soil, and starting the process back. I actually build piles of raised beds, which I call hügels or hills in German, that are made up of a bunch of dead wood that I've found anywhere, borrowed from old cut down trees. I let it age. I cover it with compost I've made from coffee grounds and food scraps, and then that becomes the beginning of deep living soil. It takes tens of thousands of years to build 60 feet of topsoil, but we can build the first 10 feet in only a few years if we use compost and trees.
That's pretty amazing that you can create that much topsoil in that short a period of time. What's the genesis for kind of the Western mode of agriculture? Western philosophy or science is supposed to be more advanced, but that seems to be kind of asinine backwards to destroy, you know, the stuff in the soil, which really feeds the plants.
I don't think that was deliberate. I think it was an unintended consequence. I mean, one of the disadvantages of the hunter-gatherer societies that leave the forests in place is they die. I mean, frankly, it's a harsh life when you're doing hunting and gathering and not digging up the soil. What happened was cities and villages grew up because people managed their environment very effectively. When you plant monocrop plants, it's more efficient production of calories. And that efficient production of calories allows a surplus, which allows the village to grow. And pretty soon you have a king and an army that defend the corn and the wheat in silos. And then they, you know, through an economic system, give that out to people who develop other trades in agriculture. And you've got cities. And cities need a rapid input of calories and big ag, which destroys the soil but is very efficient at growing calories. That naturally evolved.
Gotcha.
So I think that it was an evolutionary process, where in what we think of as the Western world, we developed very efficient but very destructive agriculture. The destructive side of it was an unintended consequence. People just wanted more food for growing populations and growing economies. But if you look at some of the more simple cultures, like, for instance, the North American Native Indians, they left the land more or less alone and lived off a small amount of agriculture and a large amount of hunting-gathering. It was very uncommon to build the tools necessary to down, you know, the 10-foot diameter trees. Whereas when the Europeans arrived, it was pretty quick that all of the trees up to the Appalachians were cut down for farm fields. And we started with a huge amount of forest in North America, and now we're down to less than 1% of our old growth forest.
So is permaculture pretty much designed for not even a village-based kind of existence, but a kind of a communal or family-based existence?
It's very much an attempt to build community. It's not just permanent agriculture, it's permanent culture. Permaculture is a social movement as much as it is a gardening movement. The goal is to create smaller villages, even within a city you can do this, create a smaller village of like-minded people who try to return their, even if they're suburban lots, return them to a more natural state with more trees and a food forest, and then share those practices with each other. And the more experienced people help the less experienced move along. I had that happen to me with one of my neighbors who helped me get started. Mm. And I'm helping a number of other people get started. This podcast is one way to do that. I also give tours of my garden. I've given talks in multiple cities about permaculture. And there are people that do it much better than I. Jeff Lawson is a famous permaculturist in Australia who gives talks. Sepp Holzer is a famous permaculturist in Austria who gives talks. And we have many, many permaculturists in America. For example, recently there was a wonderful movie called The Biggest Little Farm about a 200-acre, essentially agricultural wasteland that was horrible soil from years of over-agriculture. And that family turned it into a 200-acre lush permaculture farm that provides food but also is returning the land to deep topsoil.
It's awesome. You had mentioned that. I haven't yet had a chance to watch it, but I look forward to that. What?
I would encourage all of your listeners to try and get a hold of that movie one way or another online or go see it in theaters. I think it's very moving. And frankly, to be honest, I think it'll win the Oscar for Best Documentary.
Really? I mean, there's...
Yes, I do.
It's interesting because this year there's so much quality in terms of film around issues of food and social justice. Thomas Wade Jackson has a film as well, something about compassion, basically about veganism. But it's a very good year for film for social action.
And I think education's a huge part of this. I think as we worry about climate change, and I'm worried about it, I know you're worried about it, many people are worried about it. As we worry about the changing world, we each need to do our part. Those involved with permaculture are taking one tack, but I think everybody who recycles and uses less gasoline is also helping. We all need to help in every way we can. Mm-hmm. And the film Biggest Little Farm is one way to help. These other films you mentioned are another way to help, because if we can educate folks that lifestyle changes can make things better and that they really can make a contribution that way, then more folks will try to do that. Hmm. I'm going to be frank. I don't think we can reverse the climate catastrophe we're headed toward in any meaningful way. I think it's just going to happen.
Oh,
but if we build islands of community, if we build islands of agriculture that's not dependent on chemicals, then we can have a softer landing. Hmm. There will be areas and villages that do better as things get bad. Then some of the cities are going to have a really hard time as ocean levels rise, as drought and winds and everything else get worse. People in small, remoter areas might have a better chance of doing well. And certainly, I believe, people that have strong community will end up doing better in a time of crisis than people who don't.
No doubt. When you look at permaculture and... So how is permaculture different from regenerative agriculture? Is it different?
I think they embrace a lot of the same principles. I think permaculture tries to bring in more of the social aspect than just the agricultural aspect.
Gotcha.
Tries to bring in community and education more. But regenerative agriculture is returning the land to health.
Yeah.
And so that's a lot of the same core as permaculture.
Yeah.
I think in many cases, regenerative agriculture is sort of a halfway point between big ag and permaculture in the sense that it does involve cover crops and crop rotation and compost in the same way that permaculture does, but it's not as concerned with building deep living topsoil. I try to plant things, and many people in permaculture try to plant things on a 200 or 500 year time horizon. Obviously way past when I'm here, but what does it take to build living topsoil and a forest that will be here in 500 years? That's more permaculture. Regenerative agriculture wants to grow healthy crops and healthy soil, but it isn't planning for a 500-year horizon.
Wow. So is it a circumstance where you do not expect to use the soil that you're creating with the Hugels in the near future?
I do use that soil. I mean, I have a wide variety of things growing on my property. I mean, I mostly plant native plants, and for me, that's coast live oaks in Southern California, and sycamores, and laurel sumacs. There's a lot of things I am planting, but I also have all kinds of other things planted. I'm growing figs, pears, pomegranates, plums, grapes, avocados, oranges, mulberries, blackberries, and the usual, you know, tomatoes, squash, beans. All those things are growing on my 2 acres, mm-hmm. but they're interspersed with coast live oaks and all the other native plants. There's no rows. There's no digging. I never dig up the topsoil. I just add a little compost on top of what's there wow. and plant some seeds or dig a tree in the hoogel. And I do have to deal with critters. I mean, I've got wire around the roots of my pear trees because gophers will eat the roots otherwise. So I do things to change the land somewhat. But my goal is to have the land 80% for the trees and the wildlife and 20% for me. And that's very different from big ag, which is 100% for crop production and 0% for the wildlife or the soil.
Yeah. When we were talking about the uses of permaculture for really addressing climate change issues, one of the things I had mentioned when we talked before was, you know, in the Atlantic region, we're dealing with a lot more rain. And so trying to deal with excess moisture, and you see that obviously in the Midwest with what's happened with the floods there. But you were mentioning that hoogels are a great tool in terms of creating swales to maintain that moisture and rebuild the water table on the area that you're talking about.
Exactly. Forests have been really good at managing water, both its evaporation, its flow, and its the moderating floods and drought. Forests have been doing this for millions and millions of years. An old-growth forest is never a flat, even thing. It has hills, it has rows, it has creeks, but those are held together with tree roots. So in permaculture, we're trying to imitate that. Swales, which are hills used to direct water, swales with trees in them are a big part of permaculture design. Jeff Lawton is famous for these. The idea is to, instead of having water rapidly run off into the ocean, build swales covered with compost and living soil that trap that water and cause it to stay on the land. When I bought my property, there were driveways and gravel ditches and basically lots of things to get the brief flooding rains we have in California off the property and into the ditches and away as fast as possible. I've built an array of hoogels and swales full of trees that direct the water to stay and that soaks in where it is, building up the water table. It's really important to use good living soil because it's amazing. When I water regular soil around here, the water goes straight through the sandy soil and is gone. If there's a deep layer of compost and healthy soil, the water stays, and it doesn't leave, which is important here in Southern California where it's too dry. Yeah. By the same effect, floods are very well moderated by the natural swales of an old-growth forest, but when we cut those down, we created these flood conditions like the Midwest is experiencing. Forests have been moderating extremes of climate for millions and millions of years, and I can't go into all the ways they do that here, but it's many, many ways. And frankly, we should put some of the forest back. It's when we cut them down that the topsoil started flowing, the rivers stopped being managed. The Midwest rivers that are flooding now, basically big oak hickory forests managed those floods, and there were fewer of them. The topsoil didn't leave. Much of the water was absorbed into the deep living soil. It can take lots of it and didn't flow off into the river. So flooding was less. Once our agriculture, you know, manifest destiny moving to the west, cut all the trees down, that created a lot of flooding conditions.
You mentioned the need when you're building the hoogels to have excellent compost. What makes up a good compost? I've heard, for example, like you can't add like meat or, you know, just regular stuff off the table. You have to be more selective.
Compost recipes abound, and there's as many compost recipes as there are food recipes, and many of them work in different ways. Mm. But a few things do remain true. You want a pretty good mix of carbon things and nitrogen things. Huh. And we call them greens and browns in the compost world. Huh. So, for example, if you just tried to compost a pile of freshly cut grass from a lawn, it will become a stinky mess with all the wrong kinds of bacteria. Huh. And if you just make a pile of dry leaves, the browns, that probably won't decompose at all. It'll just stay a pile of dry leaves for a very long time, very slowly decomposing.
And I've done both of those. Yeah.
As have many of us. If you mix those two in the right ratio, and it tends to be roughly 2/3 carbon, roughly 1/3 greens of high nitrogen, if you mix it like that, it rapidly is populated with aerobic bacteria, which doesn't smell, instead of anaerobic bacteria, which is enough that stinks in a grass pile. Mm. And if you put food scraps in there, which stink if they're by themselves, but don't smell at all if you put them in that mixture of browns and greens, and then you turn it a few times, within weeks to months, you've got this deep, rich soil that's full of bacterial life. It's full of all kinds of bacteria, fungi, nematodes, all the stuff that makes living soil that can attach to plant roots. So my recipe is I go around to a lot of restaurants and coffee shops. I gather up the coffee grounds, which are actually, even though they're brown, they're high nitrogen. I gather up the food scraps from bakeries, all organic places, because I don't want poisons in my compost. I mix all that up with a ratio of roughly 2/3 browns and roughly 1/3 greens, with coffee grounds actually counting as a green. And when I turn it a few times, I make big piles of this. I turn it by hand with a pitchfork and a shovel. It's great exercise for an old guy, by the way. Mm. Pretty soon, and the way I do it, in 6 to 10 weeks, I have a really, really good compost I can use as the basis for my soil. And putting that in a hoogle with an area to put in a tree, pretty soon I've got fresh Asian pears to eat, usually within 2 years.
So do you have to keep it in the dark? Do you keep it tarped over? I mean, I've seen, like, composting bins which are black to try to bring in the heat and kind of heat up the mixture. Is that necessary or
it's
no?
It's interesting because, yeah, well, all those things are good starter tools. I recommend people just build a really good pile or a really good pile of that in a wire cage. My piles are 4 feet in diameter and about 3.5 feet high. Hmm. Those bins that you talk about are helpful for smaller composting. Smaller composting is not as quick. It's not a bad thing to do. We should all do as much composting as possible. But a larger scale, about a 4x4 pile, is much more likely to compost quickly. Hmm. The other thing you have to be very careful about is to turn it and mix it. If it stays in a soggy mess, it's going to make anaerobic bacteria, the stinky bacteria, instead of the aerobic bacteria, which doesn't smell. The smell of compost is actually an important indicator as to its health. Huh. So I encourage people to use bins if they need to, but a great big pile doesn't involve a bin, even better. And I'm not sure people understand bacterial biology, but bacteria that are converting a mix of carbon and nitrogen into compost, which is a different mix, as they do that, they generate heat. And one of the ways I track my compost is measuring the heat. Hmm. When I put a pile together, the day I put it together, of course, it's room temperature. 2 days later, it's 135 degrees in the middle, Fahrenheit.
Wow.
And 4 days later to 5 days later, it's 155 degrees in the middle. And I'm not doing anything to create that heat. The bacteria do that if they have enough carbon and nitrogen mixed stuff as fuel. And, of course, they need oxygen to do that. That's an oxygenation reaction that's going on. So bacteria generate heat. In fact, in the olden days, compost piles were used to heat homes. They would actually put them around the home, build the compost along the walls of the hut. And guess what? That hut would be a warm temperature even in snow. My compost pile, even when we get very cold weather, still maintain about 155 degrees.
Hmm. So are there additives that you make from a biological perspective of whether it's bacteria or other critters to kind of get a hugel to perform at its best, or is it just something that occurs, you know, in nature?
The bacterial mix that's best for your region or area is actually in the air. It's in what soil's left. It's around the roots of even a grass lawn. So you don't need to bring that stuff in. If you'll stir up a mix of browns and greens, the composting process will start. In a small bin, it'll get to 100 degrees. In a large pile, it'll get to 155 degrees, but it's all working fine. Mm. You may want to buy some earthworms and some composting worms. Those are available online. You don't need many. A pound will do to get the worm started. Because if you've got a suburban lawn that's been using chemicals for a long time, yeah, there aren't even any surviving worm eggs in that. So it's good to get the worm started with perhaps a small purchase. But once they are started, they keep going.
Gotcha.
Now, the worms don't grow in the hot new compost. They only start in the hugel when you're putting the temperature, the room temperature compost out. Compost goes through a cycle. It builds up to 155 degrees. And then slowly over time, it returns to ambient temperature. After about 6 to 10 weeks, the pile is cool again, and that's how you know it's done. And when it's done, just from the air and from bugs starting to crawl into it, worm eggs are already there. I mix a little soil from my hugel in with the compost. I mix the compost in with the hugel, and pretty soon it's full of worms and nematodes and all the things that make for living soil.
So you mentioned that you also use wood, like logs and such, that you find on the property. Is there a particular design structure? Are they just stacked on top of each other, and then you layer the compost on top of it, or...?
A hugel looks remarkably like putting logs into a fireplace. I generally use five logs across at the bottom, and these are fireplace-sized logs. They're about three feet long and about 6 or 8 inches in diameter, and I get a lot of them from land clearing operations that are happening in my community. When they build a new development and cut down trees, I go fetch the dead trees that they've cut up, and I get friends who are in that business to cut them up into movable lengths. So I pile five logs across, and then three logs across the gaps in that, then two logs across the gaps in that, and then one log at the top. So now I have this triangular shape, and it can be as long as I want. I tend to make them 10 to 20 feet long, and they're about 3 to 4 feet high, and they're shaped like a triangle. I then shovel compost, which I've made, onto the top of that until it's covered, and I'll plant a cover crop like clover or beans. And I keep adding compost and cover crops for about a year. And I've dug in holes there for trees, often with a wire cage to protect the roots from gophers. And that's how it starts. It's waste trees that would be just chopped up and made into mulch, probably. I save those things from around my community. I'm running around my community gathering materials all the time. And I build those into hugels, and it's a really simple process. If you just Google Hugel, H-U-G-E-L, you'll see all kinds of designs for this on the internet. And there's no one design that's the best. Whatever works for you is best.
Gotcha. And you said that over time, the Hugel that starts out at 3 or 4 feet high ends up going down in terms of height.
It does, because the wood, working with all the microbiology of the soil, decomposes and becomes more soil. And that decomposition process is such that it causes the physical size of the log to decrease. Also, over time, living soil takes over dead soil. So I often will build a hugel on top of my suburban Southern California property, and that soil is really dead after years of lawn.
Yeah.
And I don't need to dig down in that soil at all. I build a hugel on top of it, and 3 years later, the soil is really good down for a foot, and 5 years later, it's good down for 3 feet. So the hugel moves downward, taking the bacteria, fungi, and other microorganisms with it, converting the dead soil slowly to living soil.
Do you build hugels on top of each other? For example, when it does degrade over 3 to 5 years, then go in and build another hugel on top to stack the soil?
I tend not to do that. You could do that. I tend not to do that. In an old growth forest, it does that. New trees are always becoming old trees, becoming dead trees and falling over. Forests do that all the time. I've found for myself, personally, I built the hugel once, and I keep adding a foot of compost every year. And in that foot of compost, I plant different things, beans, corn, squash, trees. And it's never the same thing in the same area. I rotate everything I plant. But once my hugel starts sinking, I tend to add compost to the top so it always stays about, I keep my mounds about 2 to 3 feet high. And I do that by adding compost and adding plant matter. I don't ever plow. The hugel just keeps growing upward because of added compost and added plants. And rather than dig up a plant that's already given me tomatoes, I simply cut it off at the ground level, leaving all its roots in the ground, which causes the soil to build up over time. Those roots decompose just like the logs do. I take the cuttings, which might be, say, a tomato plant, I chop it up a bit with a shovel, and that is input to my next compost.
Gotcha.
Very effective closed living cycle, which is what an old growth forest is. That also is a closed living cycle.
Well, that's kind of the point, is how do we get to really a circular economy where we're not producing waste products and instead having things be used for, you know, products, you know, in infinity.
I tell you, Jim, I have a really good quote about that, not attributed to me. It's Toby Hemingway, who wrote a book called Gaia's Garden, which is very much an intro book to permaculture. I recommend it highly. But it says, it's short, it says, remember how self-reliant a natural landscape like an old growth forest is. An ecosystem like that provides for itself. No one brings in truckloads of fertilizer to a forest. No one carries its waste to the dump. The forest takes care of all that internally, producing fertility and recycling litter and debris. In other words, the forest inputs and outputs are balanced, leaving little waste, and all the work is powered by sunlight. This is the model we strive to emulate in permaculture.
That's awesome. That's awesome. What was the name of that book again? It's Gaia's Promise?
It's Gaia's Garden.
Garden. Gaia's Garden.
And the author is Toby Hemingway, not Hemingway, Hemingway, H-E-M-E-N-W-A-Y, one of the luminaries of permaculture here in the United States.
Very good. What do you think the impact will be on permaculture as temperatures increase due to climate change? Like I've heard many people talk about the impact of higher temperatures on food crops.
Traditional agriculture is going to be terribly affected, massively affected in a negative way by increasing temperatures.
Yeah.
A good permaculture food forest is very resilient, and you actually change the crops out, change the growth plants out as the temperature increases. Hmm. Permaculture works fine in the overheated jungles of Central America. It works great there.
True.
So over time, you may have to convert your permaculture temperate space to look more like a permaculture jungle space. But in permaculture, you're reconfiguring what plants are in what Google all the time. You don't dig anything up, but you keep adding stuff. As temperatures warm, you'll add different stuff. So your plant mix will change, but the main thing that permaculture brings to the table is resilience. It's a very resilient design philosophy that adapts to change, including droughts, floods, increasing temperature, increasing wind. All of those things are things that deep living soil, trees, and recycling agriculture can deal with much more effectively than traditional agriculture. I feel very frightened for what's going to happen to huge corn fields and huge soybean fields as the world warms, as the wind speeds increase, as the tornadoes increase, as the floods happen, as the droughts happen. That kind of agriculture is not resilient to those kinds of changes. Permaculture is.
That's awesome. And the other thing that about permaculture, too, is you're basically pulling carbon out of the atmosphere and sequestering it back into the soil, right?
That's exactly what's happening. If for no other reason than that, we should plant our old growth forests back.
Yeah.
The ideal mix of forest and city is probably 80% forest, 20% city. But right now in North America, we're probably 90% city, 10% forest. So we need to flip that around because forests push carbon into the soil. That's how the methane and carbon dioxide atmosphere that we started with on this planet became the oxygen, nitrogen atmosphere we can breathe. It happened because forests push the right materials, including carbon, deeply into the soil.
Awesome. If people want to learn more about the work that you do or reach out to you, how can they get a hold of you, Jeff?
I'd recommend they take a look at some of my project documents, and they're on something that we scientists and coders use called GitHub. So if someone goes to github.com/Jeff Bass, they'll see a lot of my projects there. And to spell it, it's github.com/Jeff Bass, J-E-F-F-B-A-S-S, which is my name.
Cool. I'll actually try to include that in the description of the podcast.
That sounds great.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for taking the time to chat, and you know, I look forward to having more conversations in the future as I kind of get my fingernails more dirty. I'm sure I'll have 1,000 questions.
And thank you, Jim, for helping us all learn more by spreading the knowledge around.
Sounds good. I'll talk to you later. Take care, bud.
Okay. Bye-bye.